It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, there were a number of big news stories this week in Wisconsin, including how to tackle the $200 million deficit facing the state in the current fiscal year.
And the biggest story from around Wisconsin came out today when state lawmakers called for a special session next week to discuss a right-to-work bill.
We're joined now by WPR news guy Noah Ovshinsky for our Wisconsin News Roundup. Noah, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here, Veronica. Happy Friday.
Back at you. Well, we have some big news looking to break here in Wisconsin regarding right-to-work legislation. What do we know so far today?
Yeah, big news. This is a big news item. In fact, it just broke a matter of a few hours ago. It turns out there will likely be a special session next week in the legislature where they will tackle right-to-work legislation. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has said in the past, you know, that this was a priority for him and many in his caucus. And now we know that the timeline, what that looks like, and in fact, it's looking like it's going to happen very quick.
Unions have been a big issue for Scott Walker over the past several years. This right-to-work legislation is more in that vein. What do we know about what right-to-work legislation is?
Right. So this deals with like private sector unions. You know, Act 10, that dealt mainly with public sector unions. This is something that exists in more than 20 states around the country. And basically, what this kind of law does is it bars companies from forcing employees to pay union dues. In other words, you know, one can't be forced to pay union dues or be a member of a union as a condition of employment.
And why are lawmakers looking for this kind of legislation right now?
Well, you know, practically speaking, you know, laws like this, you know, weaken private sector unions. And for the last several years, you know, Republican lawmakers have sought to really shrink the power of unions and their influence. We saw that with Act 10. And this is really an extension of that effort. Supporters say, you know, workers really should have a choice in the workplace. And this kind of law does that. You know, people should have the option whether or not to join a union. And supporters also say that this kind of legislation will make it easier to attract, you know, new companies and jobs to the state.
This came up earlier a few months back, and the governor seemed to be saying that he wasn't that into pursuing right-to-work legislation at the time. Where does he stand right now?
Right, exactly. So just for the last few months, you know, publicly, you know, he's urged the legislature, you know, not to take up this issue. He called it consistently, he's called it a distraction. But in a statement released just a few hours ago, his spokesperson said the governor would sign it if it landed on his desk.
And as we know, heavy Republican majorities in the legislature, how do the odds look for this passing?
Right. So generous majorities in the Assembly, in the Senate, you know, so even, you know, even if there are a few defections within the Republican Party, you know, the chances are good that it could pass. So the numbers are certainly in favor at least at this point, the numbers are in favor of legislation like this passing.
And it looks like what we're seeing is next week.
It could. It could come as a vote could come as early as next week. So a very short timeline.
Okay, moving on to look at the budget. This has been a hot topic for the past several weeks here. And one aspect of this is the budget deficit. What's going on with the budget deficit right now?
Right, right. So we've talked a lot about, you know, the next two-year budget, which the legislature, the governor has proposed and the legislature is currently digesting. But there is also this other deficit the state is dealing with, and that's the one that we are currently in, this fiscal year. Right now, that deficit is pegged at around $280 million. Democrats have said, you know, they would like the governor to push for some kind of budget repair bill. But we found out this week through a memo from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau suggesting the governor is actually looking to postpone making around $108 million in debt payments as a way to fill some of that budget hole. At least in part.
Right. And what kind of effect would that have on the state's future finances?
Well, delaying these debt payments, I mean, looking long term, it's hard to say. But the Fiscal Bureau says it will cost the state around a little over $1 million in the next two-year budget in extra interest payments, you know, if we delay paying those off now.
And does that take care of the entire deficit or just part of it?
If we're talking about this current deficit, no. We'll find out more probably in the coming weeks what will be done to actually balance that budget. You know, $108 million, that only gets us partway there. So stay tuned.
All right. Well, staying with the governor now, the governor this week declined to reconsider his decision on the Menominee Casino. And this has been a developing story with lots of twists and turns. And this seems to be the closing of the latest chapter. What happened this last week?
Right. So yesterday was the deadline for Governor Walker to reconsider his denial of the proposed casino in Kenosha. You know, it obviously means at least for now the matter has been settled, although I say for now, because there is always a chance for, at least especially in this case, the potential for legal action.
And beyond the deadline itself and Governor Walker's decision, the issue made news for some other reasons. What happened?
Yeah, so some members of the Menominee tribe actually walked something like 150 miles from their reservation to Madison this week, where they were going to ask Walker to reconsider his decision in person. This group arrived on Wednesday, were joined by others. They held a larger rally at the Capitol this week. Tribal Chair Gary Bisaw actually tried to meet with the governor, but that didn't happen. The security there did not allow that meeting to take place.
What do we know about why the governor said no again to this project?
Well, the governor said that basically it represents too big of a risk to taxpayers. And he cites an agreement that was reached several years ago, actually during the Doyle administration, with the Potawatomi that essentially requires the state to reimburse the Potawatomi if they lose money because of a rival casino. And obviously a casino in Kenosha, not far from Milwaukee, could be seen as a rival casino to the one that the Potawatomi run in Milwaukee. And so the governor says he just didn't want the state to be on the hook for any of those payments if the Potawatomi lost money.
And the Menominee had tried to say that that was not going to be an issue, but obviously wasn't enough to settle Governor Walker's mind on this point.
Right, exactly. And you know, they've gone back and forth on that point. And clearly, the governor thinks that this is just too big of a risk.
And you mentioned earlier possible legal action. What do you know about the possibility for that?
Yeah, so we quoted here at WPR some legal experts, actually. And they say that the Menominee actually could try to go to state or federal court to challenge the governor's decision. One option, they say, could be to challenge this idea that the governor actually has a veto power over land trust issues involving the tribes. That's one avenue. There are others. So while this decision by the governor may be the closing of the latest chapter, you know, my guess is there probably will be more chapters yet to be written in this issue.
It's a complicated story, one that just keeps going. We'll have to watch that one.
Yep.
And moving lastly to Bayfield County, there's been some news up in Bayfield, some debate about CAFOs. What's happening?
Right. So getting away from the Capitol for a moment, there was news made elsewhere. And in Bayfield County, there's been this debate over this potential arrival of a CAFO, which would be the first for Bayfield County.
And tell us again what a CAFO is.
That is a concentrated animal feeding operation. So these are large farms. And an Iowa-based farm has applied for permits to build a facility in Bayfield County, about 8 miles or so from Lake Superior. It's going to house about 24,000 pigs. And so there's this debate going on in the county, you know, what do we do? These are the first large-scale farms that the county could see. What do we do with that possibility?
So another one to keep an eye on.
Yeah. Bayfield County actually held a well-attended meeting this week, and the county board passed a one-year moratorium affecting farms with 1,000 or more animals. Basically, the county wants more time to study the, you know, environmental impacts of, you know, these large-scale farms, as well as what kind of oversight might be needed on the county level when it comes to these farms. So obviously, that one-year moratorium is now in effect. Stay tuned.
Noah, thanks for stopping by and catching us up on state news this week.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky, talking about the biggest headlines from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
We continue to talk about right-to-work legislation in Wisconsin. We're joined by one of the state lawmakers who's been calling for right-to-work legislation.
Representative Chris Kapinga is with us. He's a Republican state representative from Delafield. Representative Kapinga, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
So coming into his second term, Governor Walker said, you know, right to work, not a top priority, a distraction, he's called it. Why has it been a priority for you, though?
Well, it's something that I actually have been working on since I joined the legislature. I'm now coming into my third session, but it's been a very personal thing for me because back when I was 19 years old, I was working at an electrical contractor, and we get her paycheck, and I brought my pay stub into the payroll person because there was a deduction on it. And she said, that is for your union dues. And then I found out about, well, if I don't want to be part of the union, really my only option is to lose my job. And that never really sat well with me. So it's a personal thing. It's very good because what it does is it allows workers to make a choice. If they're in a union shop, they can now say, hey, you know what? I don't want to be part of the union for whatever reason, or I do want to be part of the union. If they feel there's value and they're happy with it, they can continue to choose to be in a union. The legislation is going to be clean. It's just going to simply say, you can now choose not to be in that union, and you will not lose your job.
And why now? Why is this being tackled as of this morning?
Yeah. As you know, we have been working on this for months now. This, I think, first hit maybe in October, November time frame. So people know that we've been working on it. And since the beginning, the Senate has said we want to take the lead on this. So we have been working with Senator Fitzgerald and just kind of pulsing where he's at with things. But in the meantime, we've been making sure that there's a good, solid bill in place. And Senator Fitzgerald has finally said, hey, I have the votes. So with the bill that we've got here, so we're going to move forward now. And so obviously he's calling, along with the speaker, the extraordinary session to begin that process.
So we haven't seen the bill. The draft is not out yet, or it's just coming out today. The Senate planning to vote on it by the end of next week. You and the Assembly, as I understand it, the week after. A lot of times with major legislation, there's more time for public input, public hearings. Why? A lot of people are calling this a fast track. Why?
Yeah, I don't think this is fast tracking at all. This issue, I've been getting emails from constituents since the first day we took office back in January. So this is something that has been very public. It's not fast tracking. We're still going to go through the standard hearing process. So there are time limits in the Senate and the Assembly as far as how long you have to wait to make sure that the public has proper time to give their input. And we will follow the rules on that. So the Senate is going to go in. It sounds like Senator Fitzgerald said next week, Monday, Tuesday time frame for their committee hearings where the public has a chance to come in. And then they'll be voting on it later in the week on the floor. If that happens, then the Assembly will go through our standard public hearing, and then we'll have an executive hearing most likely 48 hours or so after that. And then if it gets voted out of the executive hearing, it goes onto the floor for a vote.
It's still a fairly short amount of time. You were quoted in the Capital Times last year back in December saying people are going to be passionate about this on the other side. We will have some very healthy debate. I look forward to that. That's part of the legislative process. Given the controversy, given that this is going to be a heated issue, is this 1 week from draft release to a vote enough time?
Well, I think it's important to understand that this is not like a budget bill where it's 800 or 1,800 pages, I think the current budget bill is. This bill, and people will be able to view it probably later today, is about a page and a half. So there is not a lot in it. It lays out that, as I said, workers now have a choice. They cannot be fired if they're in a union shop and they choose not to join that union when that contract is up. So there's not a lot to the bill to understand. It's not complex in any way. When you have a page and a half bill, people will be able to go to the public hearings and express their like or dislike, and obviously the legislators who are there will listen to that and have to make their decisions.
Well, let's get into the consequences of this bill. What do you see changing in Wisconsin's economy if this what's called right-to-work legislation is passed and signed?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to make sure we don't get off of the main reason we're doing it, which, again, goes back to allowing workers that choice. But being a CPA, we've crunched the numbers from the economic side, too, because obviously that is something that constituents have said, hey, make sure that when we look at this, there's not going to be significant negative consequences. And as we pulled the numbers and analyzed the data, There's a couple of very good things that we see that right-to-work states have on a macro level that I think will down the road help our economy, and that's going to be there's things like if we look at the number of jobs, we see there's increase in jobs. Income mobility, which is really important if we want to start really tackling this poverty issue that we have. Income mobility is a key factor to that. And right-to-work states have a much better income mobility scale than non-right-to-work states. So we see things like that and we say, okay, if we can implement something that increases worker freedom and is good for people who are on a lower income scale to get them a job and then help them get up sooner or quicker, why would we not do that?
There's a lot of contradictory studies, ones from more conservative groups find these positive results, ones from groups on the left find negative results. I've seen work from a lot of economists who say, short version, reply hazy, ask again later. There's a mixed bag around the country. Do we really know what this is going to do in terms of more jobs? And also the concern often, does it lower wages if it diminishes collective bargaining power for some of these private unions?
Yeah, it is interesting because and being a CPA, I know that if you have an objective, you will be able to go find the numbers to support that objective. So there absolutely is data out there from both sides, and they will prove their point through that data. But what we did is we step back and we say we're going to look at macro numbers, so larger scale numbers, because that's what you can't really pick and choose special ones to support whatever position you want there. You kind of have to look at it as a whole. So that's what we did. We stepped back, got like Bureau of Labor Statistics reports, and we started digging through data and looking at analysis on that, and that's where we came to our conclusion. So we tried to use good data sources, not politically oriented, either left or right, and make our decision on that.
So some of the response from Democrats and unions has been the main point of this bill is to weaken private unions. There was already Act 10 on the public union side. This is an attempt to diminish the influence and power of a traditional, often opponent of Republicans.
Sure. Obviously, we've heard that from some parties, but every time that comes up, I just point out this. That is, this has nothing to do with making unions stronger or weaker. If you look at the statistics, if you look at other states who have done this, there are times when the unions actually grow stronger. And that's great. I fully support people being able to go and choose to be in a union. And if they feel that there is value in that, they have the right to do it. But if they don't feel there's value in that, right now under current law, they can't say no to it. They're forced to do it or they lose their job in union shops. So we're just saying you can have that choice. That doesn't weaken unions. If the unions are bringing good value, and even a UAW spokesperson said this, he said, you know what? It's really going to make the unions have to look and say, are we bringing value? And if we're not bringing enough value, we need to analyze ourselves and maybe work on that.
I mentioned Act 10. Do you anticipate, Representative Kapinga, any large-scale protests like we saw in the months following the release, weeks actually, following the release of the Act 10 budget repair bill?
Yeah, I don't know what to expect, but my gut just says this is not going to be something like that because that really hit a lot of people in the pocketbook. This is something that's simply allowing more liberty. So it's a very different type of legislation that we're working on right now. So I don't think we're going to see the large scale protests that we saw back in 2010.
And on a procedural and timing level, you've got a big budget to deal with. Yeah. That 800 page monster or so you mentioned. Why not get through that budget, get that behind you, and then tackle this kind of legislation?
Sure, that's a good question. The budget's actually about, I think my staff counted 1,900 pages now, and it'll continue to grow. So that is a huge task. The joint finance team, that's their main responsibility is to be going in. They're going to be holding hearings and really digging into that. That's something that typically does not come to vote until, I'm guessing, this session will most likely be June. So we have work to do on that. But just because we have the budget in front of us doesn't mean we don't work on other important things. And this is something that our caucus feels very, very, it's a very important thing to do. And again, because we have the votes now, we're going to move forward with that. But that doesn't, shouldn't, you know, the budget is its own piece of legislation. You don't just stop everything else because you're working on that.
And you don't see any stumbling blocks? This might be passed by both houses maybe 2 weeks from now?
Yeah, if everything goes well through the Senate with the votes, and obviously Senator Fitzgerald is pretty confident he got those votes or he would not have called the special session. If that passes through and they work the bill through and vote on it next week, we fully expect the Assembly to be in the week after.
Representative Kapinga, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Chris Kapinga, Republican state representative from Delafield, backing new right-to-work legislation getting into the legislature. We'll be talking more about that on this show and on the Joy Cardine Show and taking your calls and comments next week as well.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time here in the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett.
We're getting ready for the Oscars this weekend. On Sunday night, ABC will broadcast the 87th Annual Academy Awards, an event that movie buffs look forward to all year.
David Edelstein is with us to give us his predictions and fill us in on the need-to-know info going into the ceremony. He's the chief film critic for New York Magazine, Vulture.com, and NPR's Fresh Air. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, any surprises this year when it came to what films and actors were nominated?
Well, I think was the first thing that came out of people's horrified mouths was that this was the whitest slate of nominees in about two, maybe since the Civil War. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how far back you can go, and especially given the fact that there was a first-rate film, Selma, that was overlooked in just about every major category except, ironically enough, Best Picture, which was, and I use this term advisedly, a token nomination. I think that David Oyelowo, who played Martin Luther King, gave the best performance of the year, and he's not, he wasn't nominated. I think that there was a lot of surprise that American Sniper did as well as it did, and yet there was no nomination for Clint Eastwood. And as the film has become this phenomenon, you know, on par with The Passion of the Christ, more and more people are thinking, hey, you know, if Clint Eastwood had been nominated, he might have had a shot.
Well, the nominations came out a while ago, and then there's this whole lead-up period during which there are sometimes other ceremonies. What happens during that period where we assume people are, you know, rallying around particular causes and people and films? Is there a sort of horse-racy aspect that's going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, thank you for asking me this, because I feel like I forgot. I buried the lead here. I have to give you my standard disclaimer is that, it's very cynical, and many people will be put off by it, but we are not talking about artistic merit. We are talking about politics. We're talking about the politics of Hollywood. We're talking about, in some cases, liberal politics. In some cases, we're talking about a voting body that I think the average age at this point is above 55 years old. Certainly there's a lot of in the 60 to 80 year old range, overwhelmingly white, disproportionately male. It's a very, very strange and select body. And nowadays, I mean, people go into battle the way they do. You've seen the movie The War Room. Well, a lot of these movies have war rooms. And there are people, I know some of the people who work in them, and they are fantastic at what they do, at getting the nominees to cocktail parties. They're not allowed to pay for formal events, but they can call up somebody and they can say, "Hey, you know, can we bring Let's just throw out an example. Patricia Arquette. Oh, she's lovely. Can she come over to your house and can we have a bunch of people here, you know, and you know, just invite some friends, quote unquote, over to meet her. And of course, all the friends happen to be card carrying members of the Motion Picture Academy. And it's a fascinating process. Meanwhile, things are leaked to the. There's this now whole enormous press thing that's come about in the last 10 years. There are full time so-called Oscarologists. Awardologists, self-appointed experts in who's ahead, who's not ahead. And, you know, it's all based on nothing. It's actually based on, I can tell you, pretty 90%, 95% for sure who's going to win on Sunday. And I don't know anything. I mean, I'm grateful that you're having me on and I have a chance to say, I know who's going to win and I don't know anything. I'm not in Hollywood. I'm not, you know, I don't have, you know, direct lines to a lot of producers and voting members, but I know who's going to win because it's all out there. It's really sad.
Well, now that we're all depressed, let's talk about the movies.
Depressed, angry, you know.
Cynical.
There will be some really great performances that win this year. Julianne Moore, this is an example of an Oscar overdue actress meets an Oscar bait role and gives a stupendous performance, and you know the odds of her not winning are astronomical. I can't imagine anybody else winning that prize. Though there are some wonderful other performances. Marion Cotillard is great in a movie that I don't think very many people out there saw. By the way, Marion Cotillard, that's an example of what I was talking about before. When she was nominated for her Edith Piaf biopic, must have been 5 or 10 years ago, nobody gave her a shot. Julie Christie was by far the runaway favorite that year for a wonderful film called Away From Her. And Julie Christie didn't want to campaign. She didn't want to come out and press the flesh and go to these parties. Whereas Marianne, oh, I knew her publicist. They were taking her everywhere. And people were seeing how beautiful she was and how charming she was and how different she was from Edith Piaf. And she won. Well, and everybody's jaws dropped.
Well, David, let's set aside the politics and shenanigans for a moment. Let's talk artistic merit. 8 movies up for Best Picture. We'll get into some of them in turn. David, I'm gonna hold you to this. Artistic merit, those 8 movies, which movie should win? For politics aside.
Well, Boyhood is a great movie. I mean, it's unlike any a fictional movie ever made. It was a labor of love. There are many people. There's been a backlash against it, a very carefully orchestrated backlash, where people are saying, oh, it's kind of dull, and people who after the critical onrush, people. But I'm still a Boyhood guy. Boyhood going into the race was the favorite. It's not going to win, I don't think. Although Richard Linklater, oddly enough, the director and writer, might well win because people want to give him something, and that's a pretty good thing to give him. Birdman has really, in all the conversations I've seen with, the whisper conversations I've seen with Academy voters, that everything is turning toward Birdman right now. Birdman is a brilliantly made film. I thought it was awful, but brilliantly made. And I thought it was a pile of cliches and pretensions, but it is a tour de force, technically, in so many ways. It's a movie, when it's over, you just go, phew, wow, and you really want to get up and applaud just the amount of effort that went into this movie.
And we've got clips of both of those. So for people who may not have seen them, let's listen to those. We get a little taste of what we're talking about. First, we're going to start with your favorite. You say it's not going to win, but this is a clip from Boyhood.
It might win. It might win.
It might win.
Hey, Mason, what time is it?
Like 12:15.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday!
Mason, it's your birthday?
Just now, I guess.
Yeah, how old are you?
15.
15? Give me a hug. Happy birthday. Oh, my goodness.
And the amazing thing is, this is filmed over, I haven't seen it, I'll be honest, but it's filmed over the course of years with the same actors, aging.
A dozen years with the same actors, yes. It was not improvised. It was very tightly scripted, but it was sort of written on, it was written over the course of a dozen years.
And you said this one sort of changed your whole concept of what a movie was, didn't you?
I did, yes. I felt as if this movie made time visible in a way that I had never, I mean, it literally, well, I don't know that it literally made it visible, but you saw it, you know, we're used to seeing movies in which you have one actor playing a kid and one actor playing, you know, the kid a little older and one actor playing the character grown up. The way that you were able to follow this movie, I thought drove home in a way that movies usually don't, the reality of time, the fact that that kid in the first scene is gone, will never be there again. You know, just the way your kid is, you know, will be something else, or my kid, or me, or you. It made that sense of growth and at the same time loss so visible. It gave the movie such an ache that I was completely overwhelmed by it. And I know a lot of people who were, but I also people come up to me all the time and say, I don't know, it was kind of boring. It didn't have a, you know, conventional story arc. It does have this extraordinary Patricia Arquette performance, though, and she's definitely going to win. I can't imagine anybody else taking that from her. They love her out there. She's had no plastic surgery. Oh, my God. There are so many people who are so excited to give this to somebody with no plastic surgery who's over 40.
And then you mentioned Birdman, a likely winner, though you think it shouldn't be. A quick listen to that.
Are you afraid people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up comic strip character?
Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago I said no to Birdman 4.
Now, you, in your review of this movie, said, hey, this is Michael Keaton. We've seen better from Michael Keaton.
Oh, what a line to pick out. I love Michael Keaton. And I wait a minute. He's fine in this movie. He's good in this movie. He's going to win. But I mean, I've seen him, you know, we know he's got so much energy. We know he can play edgy. We know he can play characters who are full of self-pity. All of that he does beautifully here. There are performances. I mean, this is the guy who gave us Beetlejuice. This guy is capable of flying much higher than he does in Birdman. But I think the fact that Michael Keaton, and again, all these other things besides artistic merit come into the picture. Michael Keaton is a guy who, really at the height of his fame, kind of wandered away. You know, he was much more interested in being on his ranch. Some people hated him for that, but people also think, okay, you know, he's got issues. He's not a Hollywood creature. You know, he's come back, and he's putting himself in a way on trial in this movie. And, you know, we ought to recognize him for that. They think it's a career-summing-up performance.
We're talking to film critic David Edelstein. He's carefully guarding his opinions as regards the Oscars, the Academy Awards coming up this Sunday evening.
And we want to hear from you on this. Who do you think is going to win big at the Oscars this Sunday? And among the nominees, what was your favorite film? Are you planning to watch the Academy Awards? And, you know, we've heard a little bit about some of the backstage politics there. Does that matter to you? Or are you just going to watch it for the glamour and the ceremony? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and take your calls in a minute after a look at the news with Noah Ovshinsky. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion now with film critic David Edelstein about the upcoming Oscars.
And we're taking your calls, maybe your predictions, questions at 800-642-1234. Who do you think will win the awards on Sunday? Who do you think should win? How are you planning to watch the Oscars? Do you have a big Oscar party or sit home alone or skip the whole affair? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers. Now we've got Melissa on the line from Delafield. Melissa, hi.
Hi. I just
know
what your guest thought about the movie Whiplash.
Okay, good question. Whiplash. This is one that's got some nominees on the board. What did you think about this one, David?
Well, I love the movie Whiplash. It's a very young director, Damien Chazelle. And to me, the film, first of all, I've never seen a film in which the camera has so caught the spirit of the music that was being played. It was like that this movie was not nominated for cinematography, you know, when it just, the camera seemed to dance with the music. A lot of people were angry about the movie because it seems to imply that only a truly sadistic, monstrous teacher can turn, you know, a kind of formless young man into a real artist. That, in other words, you need to be abused and driven in order to be a great artist. I'm not sure that's what it's saying, but that's how a lot of people have interpreted it. I think it's a lot more open. Anyway, I love the movie. It's not going to win Best Picture. J.K. Simmons, I think, will win for Best Supporting Actor. He plays the teacher. If you know him, of course, from Oz and Law and Order, and he's just a magnificent looking guy. You know, there's like no adipose tissue on him, no fat. He's like all bald head and tight skin and sinew and, you know, nastiness. I mean, he's really a Hollywood ideal.
And David, you know, I want to ask you. I didn't see this one, but I did see the trailer, and it's one that at first seemed intriguing, but as I sat through the trailer, I found myself just cringing through the entire trailer. What was it like to see the entire movie?
It's a horror movie. It's sort of like if you can imagine the most sadistic drill sergeant. You could call it a psychodrama, but the intensity of it is unbelievable. I mean, I came out of that movie shaking. Mm. I still loved it, though. I still think it's a real achievement, and that Damien Chazelle is a terrific guy. He's probably going to win. Here's an example. Now, you want to talk about absurdity. You know, there are two categories of screenplay. There's adapted screenplay and original screenplay. Well, by anyone's definition except the Academy's, Whiplash is an original screenplay. However, in order to make the feature, Damien Chazelle made a short Whiplash film that he brought around and showed to money people in order to get the money. So they claim that his screenplay for the feature film was based on his short film. So now he's running in the category of, like, you know, side by side with people who, you know, adapted, you know, great novels. You know, he adapted the screenplay,
his own screenplay,
from his own kind of audition thing. He's probably going to win that category. That's the amazing thing.
Wow.
Let's go back to another caller. We've got Jerry on the line in Milwaukee. Jerry, hi.
Hi. I loved The American Sniper, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, Bradley Cooper is such a good-looking young man, and when you see him and you know who he is, but in this movie, he became that character. And throughout the movie, I never once thought, oh, good-looking Bradley Cooper. I just thought, oh, my God, he's the sniper. It was a riveting performance and a very good movie, I thought.
Jerry, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. David Edelstein, American Sniper, you mentioned a little more on Bradley Cooper and his performance.
I could not agree more with the caller about his performance. We're not used to seeing Bradley Cooper like this. The transformation is complete. He plays a guy who is rock hard, and yet at the same time manages to convey horror, vulnerability, sadness, the kind of the loneliness of the great warrior. I had all kinds of problems with the film, with the timeline of the film, with certain things it left out, with certain of its implications, and believe me, having said that, I got hundreds, if not more, of the sorts of emails I couldn't read on radio. But I will say that I would not be surprised if Bradley Cooper, if there were going to be a surprise at the Oscars, it could be that there is enough respect for what Bradley Cooper did and for what the movie accomplished that he could conceivably win for Best Actor. And you know what? I wouldn't be upset at all. I, probably of the five performances there, I'd vote for his.
That's interesting because this is one of the categories where the race does seem genuinely tight. It's not like the Patricia Arquette category that you say is a runaway. A lot of people are really in love with Eddie Redmayne's portrayal of Stephen Hawking, for instance, and we've got a clip of that. Let's take a listen.
There should be no boundaries to human endeavor. However bad life may seem, while there is life, there is hope.
And Eddie Redmayne bringing to life the life of Stephen Hawking, the life and love. What do you think about that performance?
It's an amazing performance. It is so great, and it's one of those cases where he's able, you know, even as the body kind of twists, as he becomes, you know, Stephen Hawking had what we, you know, popularly known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and he you know, the intellect, the anger shines out so fiercely as his body kind of twists into a pretzel and seems incapable of movement. It's really just the kind of movie that the Academy, kind of performance the Academy usually recognizes. And in fact, for a long time, he's been the front runner. And many people think it's between him and Michael Keaton. I think the movie itself is pretty lousy. I think the second half of it, especially, is a mess. It's really more about the marriage of these two characters, and it's based on the memoir of Hawking's wife. And I just don't think dramatically it adds up in any way that is terribly interesting or illuminative of either person. So he may be hurt by the movie. I don't know.
Well, another Best Actor nominee, Benedict Cumberbatch, known as Sherlock Holmes and Khan, I guess, for The Imitation Game, which I think was also up for Best Picture, if I remember correctly.
Oh, The Imitation Game is like a textbook Oscar bait biopic. It was you know, handcrafted, I think, by Harvey Weinstein, who is the Oscar bait, you know, is the great Oscar bait mogul, perhaps of this new century. The man has a real instinct for what people are going to vote for, and you know, and he hires great people to go out and campaign. The movie, there have been a lot of, as with all of these nominees, there have been a lot of people who have said this film takes so many liberties with its subject that, you know, it doesn't even, you know, it's almost a violation. It's almost a violation of this man and what he really did achieve. And I think that 20 years ago, that might not have mattered all that much. But now with the Internet pounding home this message day after day after day, you know, American Sniper, you know, distorts the facts. Selma distorts LBJ's role, you know. The Imitation Game, you know, is an insult to Alan Turing. You can't always anticipate some of these currents and countercurrents.
That's an interesting case to make. I saw that movie not knowing all of the historical ins and outs that you're referring to, and it was kind of a mind blower for me. I thought it was great.
Well, it's an absolutely gorgeously made and constructed movie. It doesn't bear too much relation to the facts. If it's a launching pad for you to look into the career of Alan Turing, you may be surprised to know that there were other people at Bletchley Park who worked on solving this code. Quite a few, in fact. That a lot of the characters did not do things that the movie says it does. And there's also a really interesting thing because Alan Turing there's a character a Soviet spy who's in Bletchley Park working on his team, and he successfully blackmails Alan Turing into keeping quiet using his knowledge of Turing's homosexuality. Now, that is that not only did that not happen, but that's was the traditional reason, that was the often stated reason for barring gays from any kind of higher government service, that they were too prone to blackmail. Now, the fact that they put this in the movie, they made this thing up and put it in the movie, I think is a legitimate source of outrage for a lot of people. Turing was much more open, you know, acknowledged much more openly his sexuality than he's shown in the movie. Some people think they de-gayed him, you know. They went easy on that for fear of alienating who? Academy voters, among others.
Well, David, we'll leave it there until Sunday night. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, I hope I haven't brought everybody's down. It's still going to be a wonderful performance. I mean, you're still going to see the crazy, glamorous people, you know, exhibitionists doing very bizarre things.
All right. David Edelstein is chief film critic for New York Magazine and Vulture.com and NPR's Fresh Air.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.